Too many people have endured some hard stresses in our region of late, and the numbers of homes destroyed in a series of wildfires indicate that thousands of people have endured a major loss, and now they have to put their lives back together, find places to live, get back eventually into a regular life routine. This is setting aside the whole disruption of COVID-19 in there as well. We expect people to have some trouble coping and have a number of systems set up to help them cope. It helps to get that attention to them quickly. We'll explore psychological first aid and long-term assistance in this hour. Two guests join us. Amy Herbst is the Student Wellness Coordinator for the Medford Schools, joining us with details of the new Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline. Amy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Good to have you. And Dr. Merritt Schreiber joins us as well from the Lundquist Institute in Southern California. He's an expert on trauma from disasters. He wrote a federal booklet on psychological first aid for parents and children after disasters and has established many protocols for helping people as they have come through traumas like what we're talking about here. Dr. Schreiber, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So Listen, Protect, Connect. I was reading this off the federal pamphlet here, but the three stages of triage for parents, two kids. Can you lay some detail upon those phases, Listen, Protect, Connect?
So Listen, Protect, and Connect is an attempt to give parents and others some just very basic strategies, three basic steps to be able to assist their children and other family members in response to disasters like the fire, COVID, and other community emergencies that occur.
If a parent is not coping particularly well themselves, what's the advice there?
So that's a really key point, because we know that, especially with younger children, how parents are coping is critically important for how kids are coping. So, the first thing for parents is to kind of be aware of how they're doing, to seek out support for themselves, to link to the resources that are available in the community. And also, there's national helplines that are available in response to disasters that are provided at no cost, for example, by HHS and SAMHSA. So definitely the first step is for the parent, to practice some self-care and to rely on, the supports they have in their own environment.
SAMHSA, again, I forget what the first two letters are, but it's Mental Health and Substance Abuse.
Right. That's mm-hmm. the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration.
That's it. Okay.
And they've created something called the Disaster Distress Helpline. So that is a place where parents can go 24/7 in multi-languages and get assistance for themselves as a first step.
Okay. So there's certainly a national helpline available. And then, Amy, talk about the creation of the Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline.
Yeah, this just came out of an idea and conversation with some of our counselors in the Medford School District when the fire swept through our valley last week. Certainly everybody wants to step up and help. And sometimes you just don't know, what people really need. And so when our counselors went to some of the places where people were gathering, they realized that there wasn't counseling set up or any kind of mental or emotional support. And so in that, we knew from what we learned back in March with COVID and all of our students having to have their school at home, we knew we had the capability of setting a hotline up. And so we did it again. And we had volunteers from within Medford School District, our counselors, our psychologists, our school-based mental health folks from Family Solutions have all volunteered their time to just be on call for anyone that just needs an empathetic ear to process their grief. What I'm realizing in my own friends that have lost their home is once the shock wears off, then that's when the dread and the sadness really comes in. And so just in thinking about, many of our people have friends and family, but what if they don't? And so that's why we have set this up.
All right. So will there be contacts available besides by the phone if people need some additional help?
Yes. That's part of our phase two, is to open up some in-person counseling within our district office. What was Central Medford High School, the downstairs area of our district office, and we're in the process of setting that up for individual counseling. And we're working closely with Phoenix Talent School District as well, as they're in recovery and working really hard to get their counseling support set up for their students and families in that area.
Merritt Schreiber, if you can address preliminarily before we get to a break about how much the COVID-19 pandemic complicates this with the kids generally not in school in person.
So I think the whole COVID context dramatically makes things more complicated. We've all been living, you know, for months and months now with COVID looming, some of us having direct impacts, you know, ill family members. Unfortunately, some have had loss of family members. There's been increases in expressions of COVID in pediatric populations. There's increasing science about that. There's some health disparities related to that also with children. So all of us have been, you know, dealing with an invisible threat that's confusing with rapidly evolving and changing health information to some extent. And then there's the public health mitigation strategies, so social distancing and school closures. The things that are probably the most commonly used by people in response to traumatic events, connecting with others and seeing others, that's not been available in COVID.
Dr. Schreiber, we were just talking about the difficulty of trying to reach out to people at a time when reaching out physically is not recommended because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Is that likely to make the effects of any further overlaying disasters like fires that much worse?
I think it does. I think it does make things much more complicated because the traditional supports that we might use because of social distancing and school closures, you know, in the case of kids, is not available. So schools provide all sorts of supports. I'm sure as our colleague from the district can attest, schools provide, you know, peer supports, specialized services for kids that are already identified with some kind of special health care need. So when you don't have access to school, some of those support systems, natural support systems to support kids through traumatic events, are not there. Then when we talk about evacuation, for example, in fires and sheltering, that's also made much more complicated because of COVID. You know, so the idea of a shelter, although nobody gets excited about going to a shelter, you don't think of it as a threat. You think of it as a refuge. Well, in the context of COVID, congregant settings where people would traditionally be, you know, all together and, you know, in food lines, buffet-style food lines and such, that's really not necessarily safe in a COVID context. So that's required some pretty significant changes to the way we would traditionally do sheltering after a wildfire.
Amy, had there already been a lot of calls for assistance from families in the Medford District for your service as student wellness coordinator because of COVID already?
Well, one thing that transpired when this happened last Tuesday is our district, the teachers and the counselors and administrators, they really reached out to check in with their students and their families. And so there was already that outreach to just see who was affected and if everyone was okay. And so with launching the hotline yesterday, we're starting to get calls throughout the, you know, we opened it up to the whole valley, not just to our school district. Again, just to provide that healing support. And we are starting to get a number of calls as this builds momentum.
You know, I've been remiss in giving the number thus far, 541-842-3643. That's staffed Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Is that right?
That's correct. And we also have a Spanish line. Can I give you that?
Yes.
So the Spanish line is available from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. And it's 541-842-3644. And we have our bilingual staff on that call.
Okay, the numbers are almost identical. I'll make sure they're both up on our website by the end of the morning. So for English speakers, Monday through Friday, 8 to 4, 541-842-3643. For Spanish speakers, Monday through Friday, 10 to 2, 541-842-3644. And while we're at it, I did call up the SAMHSA Disaster Distress Helpline as well, because if you're looking for help 24 hours a day, this is where it is. And that is 800-985-5990, 1-800-985-5990 for the SAMHSA Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration Disaster Distress Helpline. Dr. Schreiber, let's start getting into some of the phases, the things that will hit people when they've lived through a situation like these wildfires, particularly if they have had to evacuate and have discovered that their home has been lost. I mean, all the things that they're likely to go through and about the usual time pace of those events.
Yeah, so, you know, I think what happens is it's really not a one-size-fits-all. It's really how people react and kind of what their risk is for, you know, developing something more complicated or having temporary distress. What we know is there's basically kind of two pathways for families and children and adults and our first responders, for that matter, after disasters and other kinds of emergencies. In the immediate aftermath, it's extremely common for people to have what we call a transitory distress. So to be anxious, to be fearful, to have sadness, to be worried about what's coming next. But for many people, that's very time limited. So a few hours, a few days, maybe up to a couple of weeks. When those kinds of feelings and thoughts are present for more than a couple of weeks in their plateau, then we get more concerned that they might need some intervention. There's another subset of folks, somewhere between, on average, and it varies a lot from disaster to disaster, but somewhere between 20 to 40% go beyond just temporary distress and are actually on a pathway to get something we call post-traumatic stress disorder and or depression. And frequently, when you're in that group and you get a new disorder that you didn't have before, it's usually PTSD plus depression. And that requires a different set of tools and strategies. And we have some really effective interventions. But that's different than transitory distress.
All right. So transitory distress can kind of come and go, and then it isn't necessarily something that comes behind that, you're saying?
Yes. And it's really dependent on a couple of different things. One is what happened to the individual during the event. So did they evacuate and there was concern, but then they were able to go back home and their home was intact? You know, they didn't lose any pets and everybody's okay. For other folks, evacuation is kind of the start of a series of things that unfold, which could be injury, traumatic loss of loved ones, property loss, long-term displacement from, you know, your home or school, having to do extensive rebuilding. So it's not just the initial evacuation, but it's kind of what happened after that. And based on the totality of those experiences, that really determines, in our view, about whether or not you're likely to be in a transitory distress but resilience pathway. In other words, you bounce back after the immediate displacement or evacuation, versus whether the disaster or the fire is actually signaling longer-term risk because of what occurred to you.
So what kinds of things do you look for in the mental health triage, the SciStart system that you've created? I mean, what are some of the things that will help you figure out, okay, this person looks like it's just transitory distress versus this person looks like they're getting into something deeper?
So what's different about SciStart is because, as I mentioned, so many people have transitory distress in the immediate aftermath, and that's not necessarily indicative that they need a mental health provider or that they have significant mental health risk. So SciStart does not look at immediate distress, because if you just look at distress, you're going to vastly overestimate actual risk. So instead of looking at symptoms or distressed feelings, we look at actual things that occurred, such as was their home lost? Did they have a complicated or delayed evacuation? In other words, did they have to evacuate through flames, or were they not able to evacuate? Were parents and children or other family members separated during the event? Was a family member injured, severely injured? Was the individual exposed to gruesome sights, you know, injured animals or injured folks or, you know, scenes of their own property or home, you know, in flames or being damaged? It's all of those kind of, we call those objective features or exposure features. Some people refer to that as a, quote, dose of exposure. So when those things start to, you know, accrue at the individual level, then we start to see increased potential for risk.
We're talking about post-fire trauma and ways in which it can be diverted from turning into post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Merritt Schreiber of the Lundquist Institute in Los Angeles has been working in this field for a very long time now and has developed some protocols for helping people after a disaster. And we're also talking to Amy Herbst, who is the student wellness coordinator for the Medford School District. I had a hand in creating the Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline. I'll give those numbers again in a minute. Let me give you our numbers right now if you would like to talk to us about this. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'll get to the emotional wellness hotline numbers again in a minute. Amy, you said people are already starting to make use of the system?
Yeah, we, yes, as of yesterday, we were getting a few calls to trickle in because we put it out not only on the district website, but out on our social media channels, and so people are starting to utilize it.
Now, this is not, I want to make sure that the clear, this is a Rogue Valley emotional wellness hotline. It is not just for the Medford School District.
It's not just for the Medford School District, but I want to be clear that, you know, we are a smaller district, and so it really is for the Rogue Valley.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. But for example, I mean, you mentioned taking some calls, I think, from folks in the Phoenix Talent School District,
yes,
which have obviously been heavily hit. Within the Medford School District, are you aware of many families that lost homes? I mean, we're talking potentially 50% loss of homes to families that have kids in the Phoenix Talent District.
Oh, absolutely. We have students that are on transfer from Phoenix Talent. We also have a number of staff members that lived in Phoenix Talent. And so, you know, we are quickly trying to support them and get their needs met, you know, teachers and some of our support staff. I want to say up to almost 20 lost their homes in this fire. So, you know, again, we're just trying to do what we can to support our people.
All right, let me give you the numbers again. The Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline, 541-842-3643, 541-842-3643, staffed Monday morning through afternoon, so 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. Spanish speakers have a slightly narrow window, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday, 541-842-3644. Now, it's interesting, now we get into talking about media just a bit, and Dr. Schreiber, I know social media is all over the place now. This is how a lot of people get their information in the first place. And I noticed that in the work you had done previously to talk about how parents can help their kids in disaster, you don't want to let the kids see much media of the disaster, and the reference was to newspapers and television, but how much harder is preventing kids from seeing images of the disaster in an age of people who can text you entire videos?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, and I don't think we fully know the extent of it, but it's definitely, you know, changed the way you know, people and kids are exposed to information. And, you know, it's often the case that parents don't have necessarily, you know, the micro view of what kids are being exposed to. So we definitely encourage, you know, parents and older kids to kind of have a media plan for themselves about, you know, what the level of information, you know, input they can handle before it's over. There's definitely some evidence from 9/11, from Oklahoma City. From some extent, there's some research that some colleagues did at UC Irvine on COVID-19 that, you know, unbridled exposure to you know, images and news reports and in social media can definitely make you more anxious, can make you more upset, and, you know, not be helpful information is critical with evacuation, getting to resources, talking as we are now about emotional coping and resources such as the school has. But there's a point where there's not further gain from just, you know, information that repeats every hour. We've seen here in Southern California where in shelter environments, for example, where folks are glued around television reports and they're watching kind of the same helicopter footage of acres burning and structures burning and, you know, fire containment efforts. And those tend to repeat. There's a limited amount of new information flow. So people sometimes in a shelter are watching television, usually trying to figure out what the impact is in their own home and their own community, their own friends and neighbors. But they're exposed to the same visual images over and over and over again. And that probably has, for many folks, a negative impact. It doesn't really add to their coping.
All right. So there's a value in being informed, but it sounds like this, the same stuff over and over again. Does something in our more primitive brain parts just assume that this is all mounting up, that this is not just one incident viewed over and over?
I think that's definitely the case for kids. You know, I was involved with a young child after 9/11 who lost two of his family members in the World Trade Center. And when he would see the instant replays, you know, in the hours, days, and weeks after 9/11, initially he was confused about whether that was replay or new events. So can you imagine what that's like if you don't understand that that's a replay of the same event over and over, and those are new attacks? So depending on developmental level, you know, can you think of, you know, that would give you the impression that you're under continuous attack or the fire is continuing. So definitely younger kids have a bit more difficulty understanding that concept of instant replay versus it's a new event that's continuing to expand.
And I'm always struck by the reminder that, that kids have to be reminded that the event is not their fault. I mean, what is it about childlike thinking that leads down that road?
It's just the nature of children's cognitive abilities, and it's a function of their age, largely. But their ability to kind of, what we call decenter, to kind of understand action outcomes other than just themselves, that's something that we learn over time. And depending on your age, you don't really understand the input of others as well as you do when you get a bit older. So therefore, when good things happen, it's because of you. And when not so good things happen, it's also because of you. And it's simply because they have limited ability to do what we call cognitive decentering, to understand the role of others and outcomes.
Amy Schreiber, I know it's early days. Any thought to services in addition to the Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline, that other events or physical in-person offerings, which are granted, again, we're dealing with COVID too.
Yes, actually, we're in the process of launching, hopefully by middle of next week, FEMA application help. So for English and Spanish people affected by the fire, if they need assistance, I'm working with a retired teacher from the Medford School District, Wanda Lee, and she's gathering volunteers to also host this event starting, again, hopefully next week, and we'll get that information out as soon as possible. To host at the district office for anyone that just needs help navigating that application.
Merritt Schreiber, I assume with California having as many large destructive fires as it has had in recent years, you've had a chance to test out your systems in the field a fair amount.
We have, and, you know, I'm excited to tell you that we actually have a new initiative that just started in the last few weeks in Sonoma County in Northern California that's had three presidentially declared wildfires and actually a presidentially declared flood event last year as well. And what we're doing in collaboration with Sonoma County Office of Education and nine school districts in Sonoma County is what we're calling SciStart Stepped Triage to Care. So basically, we're doing phone triage with as many students in those nine school districts as possible, kind of in a phased sequence, starting with the most impacted areas and districts, and then, you know, proceeding from there. the folks and the children that are looking like they might be at significant risk based on those risk factors that I mentioned earlier on SciStart: loss of their home, displacement, injury, complicated evacuation, injury or illness, et cetera, they are then linked to a clinical counselor that's providing what we call trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, or TFCBT. TFCBT is developed by a group in Pittsburgh and is really an international best practice for very traumatized children that have post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's not for temporary distress. It's really for those that have had significant exposure and actually have symptoms consistent with this diagnosis. So what we're doing is triage essentially for as many of the kids we can reach across those nine districts, and then linking them, this is all via telehealth because of COVID, and also because this is a largely rural community where coming in for services can be more complicated. So the model was already telehealth before COVID, and then we've further made it available to be delivered remotely. So the high risk from the triage tool then get linked to a therapist who then assesses them a bit more, and if the parent and the child are wanting further service delivery and they fit those criteria for risk, then they're receiving trauma-focused CBT in a kind of two-phased approach. They get an initial 4 hours, which is kind of a resilient skills base. So it teaches them mindfulness, how to regulate their emotions, how to understand the impact of trauma, how parents can help their kids manage those feelings and thoughts, get them back into, you know, adaptive routine. And then we reassess them again after about four sessions. For those that are sufficiently improved and things are kind of back going well, that's kind of the end of it. And we would then watch and consult with them and be available for them should something return. For those that are still pretty symptomatic and pretty distressed at that point, they would then go on to get another several hours of intervention that's already been shown to be very effective for kids in all sorts of traumatic events.
Is there a window, Dr. Schreiber? Is there a golden month, I guess is the term you use, where if you don't do something to acknowledge the distress, that it will become PTSD or could become PTSD?
So we have good treatments for adults and kids for both post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Those are the most common things that occur after disasters. So I want to be clear that there's effective treatments. Not all treatments are the same, but there's definitely what we call evidence-based interventions out there, such as trauma-focused CBT for PTSD in kids. What we're exploring, and we definitely need to learn more and to have a bigger research base, is if we get to this high-risk subset very early, earlier than we typically do, so within that first month, within that first 30 days, technically, after an acute traumatic event or disaster like the fire, you can't actually get a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder for 30 days. So there's a 30-day window when we're trying to see if we get just to that high-risk subset. So it's not everyone who's impacted. It's not folks that are having transitory distress. It's for those that are having distress plus those risk factors that we've been discussing. If we then do things like trauma-focused CBT for kids, and there's a parallel intervention for adults as well, can we then reduce or mitigate the subsequent development of PTSD? And there's some preliminary evidence that that may be possible to reduce that risk or maybe even eliminate it. We need to know more, but that's definitely the area where we're very engaged right now in trying to push the ball down the road to see if we get to high-risk folks early, can we alleviate that risk and prevent, the consequences.
Now, Amy, at the Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline, and let me give those numbers again, Monday, Friday, 8 to 4, 541-842-3643, 541-842-3643. Spanish-speaking help available 10 to 2 Monday through Friday at almost the same number, 541-842-3644, 541-842-3644. You indicated earlier, Amy, that you'll be having school counselors and other people who have some qualifications here, but is there a common scenario, procedural set you're working with here?
It's just being an empathetic ear, and all of our school counselors and school-based therapists are all trained in trauma-informed practices, adverse childhood experiences, as well as grief and loss counseling. And so nothing specific. It's really meant just to allow for people to process and tell their story and just, you know, have somebody sort of metaphorically hold their hand through it. And then we have, they all have the crisis lines and the other local resources at hand should they need to refer anybody out.
That really is a major part of it. It's, I mean, and in so many things, I mean, people just need somebody to hear them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that was the big thing that we walked away with as a staff was, you know, once the sadness really does set in, you know, hopefully most of our community have people, have family and friends that they can go to. But just the thought of people not knowing who to call or who to talk to, you know, we just really wanted to step up and help.
Mm-hmm. How many people do you have available to be able to staff the hotline?
We have dedicated volunteers through about 4 weeks. And I'm continuing to add volunteers every day. But we've got about 50 people that have counseling backgrounds. And so we're just, having them sign up for time slots throughout that 8 to 4 during their workday. And then it all goes through this app and rings to their cell phone. So, you know, while people are working, they can just be on call to take calls from those that may be affected by the fire.
Okay, I was going to ask if you ran out of phone lines at some point, but it sounds like it diverts to people's individual phones, so people can get help anytime during the time it's open. 50 people, that is impressive.
Yeah, you know, we have our school counselors, our school psychologists. We have a great partnership with Family Solutions. We've got administrators that have counseling backgrounds. And then we've got elementary folks that are involved in social emotional wellness as well. And so, again, this was voluntary within our organization, and a lot of people just stepped up with their skills and knowledge and wanted to help, so they signed up.
Okay, and I should point out, too, that the Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline, because it is only staffed Monday through Friday, morning to afternoon, also says if you're in crisis and need an urgent response, you can call the Jackson County Crisis Hotline. I'll give you another number there. I know people don't listen to the radio with their pens and pencils out necessarily, so all the stuff will go on our website. But that number is 541-774-8201, 541-774-8201. That's an around-the-clock Jackson County Crisis Hotline. So we'll put those three numbers plus the SAMHSA National Disaster and Distress Helpline up on our website at jeffexchange.org. Dr. Schreiber, I notice in some of your materials that one of the ways to get kids in particular engaged and try to keep them moving forward is to find ways for them to be helpful. In what kinds of ways?
Well, you know, it really depends on kind of their age, but when kids can participate in community activities, I've seen that. I can't tell you how many times I've seen kids come to shelter environments, want to volunteer, want to help out, moving supplies around, being part of, shelter activities. And I think, you know, to the extent that people are kind of engaged in their own community's recovery rather than just sort of sitting on a shelter cot, that's definitely, you know, to their advantage.
What is there really a thing called survivor's guilt in a situation like this, in a people who didn't lose their homes and get to go back and pick up life pretty much as it was?
You know, I think that's very, very often there's something, I don't use those exact words, but there's something akin to that does occur. There's kind of the randomness. We see that in wildfires where on one side of the street, every house is wiped out. And then across the street, maybe 50 feet away, the house is completely unscathed. And, you know, that's difficult for those that lost their home.
it's also difficult in a different sort of way for those that survive. All their neighbors are gone. You know, what did they do? How did they survive that? You know, and it's kind of that randomness. We all like to think there's some order, you know, to our lives and to the universe. And what you see in natural disasters is kind of that the random pattern of impact and damage and loss. That's hard to deal with. And when you're on the side where, you know, your house survived, that also has its challenges.
It's okay to have a good cry, I think, is one of the things that people need to get across. And
definitely.
Yeah, Amy Herbst, I mean, I imagine that there are quite a few tears shed by quite a few people in the Rogue Valley, and that perhaps some in your presence and perhaps you even, I don't know. But this is, it's interesting to hear people say, you know, I think I need a good cry, but I'm not sure how to get started.
Certainly, absolutely. You know, we have our tears for a reason, as I'm sure our colleague can attest to. And, you know, and so just being able to be an empathetic ear and just hold space for people in their sadness, I think, you know, can go a long way. You know, that's how our psyches and our bodies, you know, process all of this. So I agree. A good cry, absolutely necessary.
Merritt Schreiber, for those of us who aren't mental health professionals, we see people struggling. Besides listening, what are the things we can do?
Well, I think to definitely, you know, the more serious sides of things, severe depression. We already have a crisis of suicide in our country. So it's to be aware of that, how people are doing, and to not be afraid to ask. I think that's the most important thing, is to know that those around you are interested in how you're doing and aren't afraid to ask you maybe sometimes difficult questions. That's one piece of it. And then I think it's normalizing, you know, using resources such as the helpline that our colleague is talking about, or things like the disaster stress helpline. There's also a national suicide prevention hotline that SAMHSA also runs. So it's encouraging people and protecting them by connecting them to resources.
Of which there are a great number, clearly, around there. And so, yes, we'll make sure we get all these up. I'll mention them again before we go. So the Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline, brand new, and looks like 4 weeks of dedicated volunteers, as Amy Herbst is telling us, to be able to answer phones Monday through Friday, 8 to 4, 541-842-3643. 541-842-3643. Spanish Help 10 to 2 Monday through Friday. Almost the same number, 541-842-3644. 541-842-3644. And then the national SAMHSA Disaster Distress Helpline is 800-985-5990. 800-985-5990. We'll put these all up on our website at jeffexchange.org. Send them out on social media by the time the morning is out as well. I want to thank Amy Herbst for joining us, student wellness coordinator for the Medford School District, in helping to put together the Rogue Valley Emotional Wellness Hotline. Amy, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.
All right, good to have you. Dr. Merritt Schreiber from the Lundquist Institute in Los Angeles, an expert on PTSD from disasters. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, take care. That'll